get your password.
That would be awkward, yes.
I trust you've written it down, she said wryly.
Blasphemy, Edmund said, laughing. Computer scientists never write down passwords. Not to worry, though. Mine is only 47 characters long. I'm sure I won't forget it. Ambra's eyes widened.
47? Edmund, you can't even remember the four-digit PIN for your museum security card. How are you going to remember 47 random characters?
He laughed again at her alarm. I don't have to. They're not random. He lowered his voice.
My password is actually my favorite line of poetry.
Ambra felt confused.
You used a line of poetry as a password?
Why not? My favorite line of poetry has exactly 47 letters.
Well, it doesn't sound very secure.
No? You think you can guess my favorite line of poetry?
I didn't even know you like poetry.
Exactly. Even if someone found out that my password was a line of poetry, and even if someone guessed the exact line out of millions of possibilities, they would still need to guess the very long phone number I used to dial into my secure server.
The phone number you just speed-dialed from your phone?
Yes. A phone that has its own access PIN and never leaves my breast pocket. Ambra threw up her hands, smiling playfully.
Okay, you're the boss, she said. By the way, who's your favorite poet?
Nice try, he said, wagging his finger. You'll have to wait till Saturday. The line of poetry I've chosen is perfect. He grinned. It's about the future, a prophecy. And I'm happy to say it's already coming true. Now, as her thoughts returned to the present, Ambra glanced over at Edmund's body and realized with a rush of panic that she was no longer able to see Langdon.
Where is he?
More alarming, she now spotted the second Guardia officer, Agent Diaz, climbing back into the dome through the slit cut into the fabric wall. Diaz scanned the dome and then began moving directly toward Ambra.
He'll never let me out of here.
Suddenly, Langdon was beside her. He placed his hand gently on the small of her back and began guiding her away, the two of them moving briskly toward the far end of the dome, the passageway through which everyone had entered.
Ms. Vidal, Diaz shouted, where are you two going?
We'll be right back, Langdon called, hastening her across the deserted expanse, moving in a direct line toward the rear of the room and the exit tunnel.
Mr. Langdon,
it was Agent Fonseca's voice, shouting behind them,
you are forbidden to leave this room.
Ambra felt Langdon's hand pressing more urgently on her back.
Winston,
Langdon whispered into his headset.
Now.
A moment later, the entire dome went black. Chapter 28. Agent Fonseca and his partner Diaz dashed through the darkened dome, illuminating the way with their cell phone flashlights and plunging into the tunnel through which Langdon and Ambra had just disappeared. Halfway up the tunnel, Fonseca found Ambra's phone lying on the carpeted floor. The sight of it stunned him. Ambra jettisoned her phone? The Guardia Real, with Ambra's permission, used a very simple tracking application to keep tabs on her location at all times. There could be only one explanation for her leaving her phone behind. She wanted to escape their protection. The notion made Fonseca extremely nervous, although not nearly as nervous as the prospect of having to inform his boss that the future Queen Consort of Spain was now missing. The Guardia commander was obsessive and ruthless when it came to protecting the prince's interests. Tonight, the commander had personally tasked Fonseca with the simplest of directives.
Keep Ambra Vidal safe and out of trouble at all times.
I can't keep her safe if I don't know where she is. The two agents hurried on to the end of the tunnel and arrived at the darkened anteroom, which now looked like a convention of ghosts, A host of pale, shell-shocked faces illuminated by their cell phone screens as they communicated to the outside world, relaying what they had just witnessed.
"Turn on the lights," several people were shouting.
Fonseca's phone rang, and he answered.
"Agent Fonseca, this is museum security," said a young woman in terse Spanish. "We know you've lost lights up there. It appears to be a computer malfunction. We'll have power back momentarily."
"Are the internal security feeds still up?"
Fonseca demanded, knowing the cameras were all equipped with night vision.
"They are, yes."
Fonseca scanned the darkened room.
"Umbra Vidal just entered the anteroom outside the main theater. Can you see where she went?"
"One moment, please."
Fonseca waited, heart pounding with frustration. He had just received word that Uber was experiencing difficulties tracking the shooter's getaway car. Could anything else go wrong tonight? Fatefully, tonight was his first time on Umbra Vidal's detail. Normally, as a senior officer, Fonseca was assigned only to Prince Julian himself. And yet this morning, his boss had taken him aside and informed him,
"Tonight, Ms. Vidal will be hosting an event against the wishes of Prince Julian. You will accompany her and make sure she is safe."
Fonseca never imagined that the event Umbra was hosting would turn out to be an all-out assault on religion, culminating in a public assassination. He was still trying to digest Umbra's angry refusal to take Prince Julian's concerned call. It all seemed inconceivable, and yet her bizarre behavior was only escalating. By all appearances, Umbra Vidal was attempting to ditch her security details so she could run off with an American professor. If Prince Julian hears about this...
"Agent Fonseca," the security woman's voice returned, "we can see that Ms. Vidal and a male companion exited the anteroom. They moved down the catwalk and have just entered the gallery housing Louise Bourgeois' cells exhibit. Out the door, turn right, second gallery, on your right."
"Thank you. Keep tracking them."
Fonseca and Diaz ran through the anteroom and exited onto the catwalk. Far below, they could see throngs of guests moving quickly across the lobby toward the exits. To the right, exactly as security had promised, Fonseca saw the opening into a large gallery. The exhibit sign read, "Cells." The gallery was expansive and housed a collection of strange, cage-like enclosures, each containing its own amorphous white sculpture.
"Ms. Vidal!" Fonseca shouted. "Mr. Langdon!"
Receiving no answer, the two agents began searching. Several rooms behind the Guardia agents, just outside the domed auditorium, Langdon and Umbra were climbing carefully through a maze of scaffolding, making their way silently toward the dimly lit exit sign in the distance. Their actions of the last minute had been a blur, with Langdon and Winston collaborating on a quick deception. On Langdon's cue, Winston had killed the lights and plunged the dome into darkness. Langdon had made a mental snapshot of the distance between their position and the tunnel exit, his estimate nearly perfect. At the mouth of the tunnel, Umbra had hurled her phone into the darkened passageway. Then, rather than entering the passage, they turned around, remaining inside the dome, and doubled back along the inner wall, running their hands along the fabric until they found the torn opening through which the Guardia agent had exited in order to pursue Edmund's killer. After climbing through the opening in the fabric wall, the two made their way to the outer wall of the room and moved toward a lit sign that marked an emergency exit stairwell. Langdon recalled with amazement how quickly Winston had arrived at the decision to help them. "If Edmund's announcement can be triggered by a password," Winston had said, "then we must find it and use it at once. My original directive was to assist Edmund in every way possible to make his announcement tonight a success. Obviously, I have failed him in this, and anything I can do to help rectify that failure, I will do." Langdon was about to thank him, but Winston raced on without taking a breath. The words streamed from Winston at an inhumanly fast pace, like an audiobook playing at an accelerated speed. "If I myself were able to access Edmund's presentation," Winston said, "I would do so immediately, but as you heard, it is stored in a secure server, off-site. It appears that all we require to release his discovery to the world is his customized phone and password. I have already searched all published texts for a 47-letter line of poetry, and unfortunately the possibilities number in the hundreds of thousands, if not more, depending on how one breaks the stanzas. Furthermore, because Edmund's interfaces generally lock out users after a few failed password attempts, a brute force attack will be impossible. This leaves us only one option. We must find his password in another manner. I am in agreement with Ms. Vidal that you must gain access immediately to Edmund's home in Barcelona. It seems logical that if he had a favorite line of poetry, he would possess a book containing that poem, and perhaps even have highlighted his favorite line in some manner. Therefore, I calculate a very high probability that Edmund would want you to go to Barcelona, find his password, and use it to release his announcement as planned. In addition, I have now determined that the last-minute phone call that requested Admiral Avila be added to the guest list did indeed originate in the Royal Palace in Madrid, as Ms. Vidal stated. For this reason, I have decided that we cannot trust the Guardia Real agents, and I will devise a way to divert them and thereby facilitate your escape. Incredibly, it appeared that Winston had found a way to do just that. Langdon and Ambra had now reached the emergency exit, where Langdon quietly opened the door, ushered Ambra through, and closed the door behind them. "Good," Winston's voice said, materializing again in Langdon's head. "You're in the stairwell." "And the Guardia agents?" Langdon asked. "Far away," Winston replied. "I am currently on the phone with them, posing as a museum security officer and misdirecting them to a gallery at the far end of the building." "Incredible," Langdon thought, giving Umbra a reassuring nod. "All good." "Descend the stairs to ground level," Winston said, "and exit the museum. Also, please be advised, once you exit the building, your museum headset will no longer have a connection to me." "Damn!" The thought had not occurred to Langdon. "Winston," he said hurriedly, "are you aware that Edmund shared his discovery with a number of religious leaders last week?" "That seems unlikely," Winston replied, "although his introduction tonight certainly implied that his work has profound religious implications, so perhaps he wanted to discuss his findings with leaders in that field?"
"I think so, yes. One of them, however, was Bishop Valdespino from Madrid."
"Interesting. I see numerous references online stating that he is a very close advisor to the King of Spain."
"Yes, and one more thing," Langdon said. "Were you aware that Edmund received a threatening voicemail from Valdespino after their meeting?"
"I was not. It must have come on a private line."
"Edmund played it for me. Valdespino urged him to cancel his presentation and also warned that the clerics with whom Edmund had consulted were considering a preemptive announcement to undermine him somehow before he could go public." Langdon slowed on the stairs, permitting Amber to press ahead. He lowered his voice. "Did you find any connection between Valdespino and Admiral Avila?" Winston paused a few seconds.
"I found no direct connection. But that does not mean one does not exist. It just means it's not documented."
They approached the ground floor.
"Professor, if I may," Winston said, "considering the events of this evening, logic would suggest that powerful forces are intent on burying Edmund's discovery. Bearing in mind that his presentation named you as the person whose insight helped inspire his breakthrough, Edmund's enemies might consider you a dangerous loose end."
Langdon had never considered the possibility and felt a sudden flash of danger as he reached the ground floor. Umbra was already there, heaving open the metal door.
"When you exit," Winston said, "you will find yourselves in an alley. Move to your left around the building and proceed down to the river. From there, I will facilitate your transportation to the location we discussed."
BIO-EC346, Langdon thought, having urged Winston to take them there.
the place where Edmund and I were supposed to meet after the event. Langdon had finally deciphered the code, realizing that BIO-EC-346 was not some secret science club at all. It was something far more mundane. Nonetheless, he hoped it would be the key to their escape from Bilbao. If we can make it there undetected, he thought, knowing there would soon be roadblocks everywhere. We need to move quickly. As Langdon and Ambra stepped over the threshold into the cool night air, Langdon was startled to see what looked like rosary beads scattered across the ground. He didn't have time to wonder why. Winston was still talking. Once you reach the river, his voice commanded, go to the walkway beneath La Salve Bridge and wait until... Langdon's headset blared suddenly with deafening static. Winston? Langdon shouted. Wait until what? But Winston was gone, and the metal door had just slammed shut behind them. Chapter 29. Miles to the south, on the outskirts of Bilbao, an Uber sedan raced along Highway AP-68, en route toward Madrid. In the back seat, Admiral Avila had removed his white jacket and naval cap, enjoying a sense of freedom as he sat back and reflected on his simple escape, precisely as the regent promised. Almost immediately after entering the Uber vehicle, Avila had drawn his pistol and pressed it against the head of the trembling driver. At Avila's command, the driver had tossed his smartphone out the window, effectively severing his vehicle's only connection with the company's headquarters. Then Avila had gone through the man's wallet, memorizing his home address and the names of his wife and two children. Do as I say, Avila had told him, or your family will die. The man's knuckles had turned white on the steering wheel, and Avila knew he had a devoted driver for the night. I am invisible now, Avila thought, as police cars raced by in the opposite direction, sirens wailing. As the car sped south, Avila settled in for the long ride, savoring the afterglow of his adrenaline-fueled high. I have served the cause well, he thought. He glanced at the tattoo on his palm, realizing that the protection it provided had been an unnecessary precaution, at least for now. Feeling confident that his terrified Uber driver would obey orders, Avila lowered his pistol. As the car rushed toward Madrid, he gazed once again at the two stickers on the car's windshield. What are the chances? He thought. The first sticker was to be expected, the Uber logo. The second sticker, however, could only have been a sign from above, the papal cross. The symbol was everywhere these days, Catholics around Europe showing solidarity with the new pope, praising his sweeping liberalization and modernization of the church. Ironically, Avila's realization that his driver was a devotee of the liberal pope had made pulling a gun on the man an almost pleasurable experience. Avila was appalled at how the lazy masses adored this new pontiff, who was permitting the followers of Christ to pick and choose from a buffet table of God's laws, deciding which rules were palatable to them and which were not. Almost overnight, inside the Vatican, questions of birth control, gay marriage, female priests, and other liberal causes were all on the table for discussion. 2,000 years of tradition seemed to be evaporating in the blink of an eye. Fortunately, there are still those who fight for the old ways. Avila heard strains of the Oriamendi hymn playing in his mind. And I am honored to serve them. Chapter 30. Spain's oldest and most elite security force, the Guardia Real, has a fierce tradition that dates back to medieval times. Guardia agents consider it their sworn duty before God to ensure the safety of the royal family, to protect royal property, and to defend royal honor. Commander Diego Garza, overseer of the Guardia's nearly 2,000 troops, was a stunted and weedy 60-year-old with a swarthy complexion, tiny eyes, and thinning black hair worn slicked back over a mottled scalp. His rodent-like features and diminutive stature made Garza nearly invisible in a crowd, which helped camouflage his enormous influence within the palace walls. Garza had learned long ago that true power stemmed not from physical strength, but from political leverage. His command of the Guardia Real troops certainly gave him clout, but it was his prescient political savvy that had established Garza as the palace's go-to man on a wide array of matters, both personal and professional. A reliable curator of secrets, Garza had never once betrayed a confidence. His reputation for steadfast discretion, along with an uncanny ability to solve delicate problems, had made him indispensable to the king. Now, however, Garza and others in the palace faced an uncertain future as Spain's aging sovereign lived out his final days at the Palacio de la Zarzuela. For more than four decades, the king had ruled a turbulent country as it established a parliamentary monarchy following 36 years of bloody dictatorship under the ultra-conservative general Francisco Franco. Since Franco's death in 1975, the king had tried to work hand-in-hand with the government to cement Spain's democratic process, inching the country ever so slowly back to the left. For the youth, the changes were too slow. For the aging traditionalists, the changes were blasphemous. Many members of Spain's establishment still fiercely defended Franco's conservative doctrine, especially his view of Catholicism as a state religion and moral backbone of the nation. A rapidly growing number of Spain's youth, however, stood in stark opposition to this view, brazenly denouncing the hypocrisy of organized religion and lobbying for greater separation of church and state. Now, with a middle-aged prince poised to ascend to the throne, nobody was certain in which direction the new king would lean. For decades, Prince Julian had done an admirable job of performing his bland ceremonial duties, deferring to his father on matters of politics and never once tipping his hand as to his personal beliefs. While most pundits suspected he would be far more liberal than his father, there was really no way to know for sure. Tonight, however, that veil would be lifted. In light of the shocking events in Bilbao and the king's inability to speak publicly due to his health, the prince would have no choice but to weigh in on the evening's troubling events. Several high-ranking government officials, including the country's president, had already condemned the murder, shrewdly deferring further comment until the royal palace had made a statement, thereby depositing the entire mess in Prince Julian's lap. Garza was not surprised. The involvement of the future queen, Ambra Vidal, made this a political grenade that nobody felt like touching. "Prince Julian will be tested tonight," Garza thought, hurrying up the grand staircase toward the palace's royal apartments. "He is going to need guidance, and with his father incapacitated, that guidance must come from me." Garza strode the length of the Residencia hallway and finally reached the prince's door. He took a deep breath and knocked. "Odd," he thought, getting no answer. "I know he's in there." According to Agent Fonseca in Bilbao, Prince Julian had just called from the apartment and was trying to reach Ambra Vidal to make sure she was safe, which, thank heavens, she was. Garza knocked again, feeling rising concern when he again got no answer. Hastily, he unlocked the door. "Don Julian?" he called, as he stepped inside. The apartment was dark except for the flickering light of the television in the living room. "Hello?" Garza hurried in and found Prince Julian standing alone in the darkness, a motionless silhouette facing the bay window. He was still impeccably dressed in the tailored suit he had worn to his meetings this evening, having not yet so much as loosened his necktie. Watching in silence, Garza felt unsettled by his prince's trance-like state. This crisis appears to have left him stunned. Garza cleared his throat, making his presence known. When the prince finally spoke, he did so without turning from the window. "When I called Ambra," he said, "she refused to speak to me." Julian's tone sounded more perplexed than hurt. Garza was unsure how to reply. Given the night's events, it seemed incomprehensible that Julian's thoughts were on his relationship with Ambra, an engagement that had been strained right from its poorly conceived beginnings.
"I imagine Ms. Vidal is still in shock," Garza offered quietly. "Agent Fonseca will deliver her to you later this evening. You can't speak then. And let me just add how relieved I am knowing that she is safe."
Prince Julian nodded absently.
"The shooter is being tracked," Garza said, attempting to change the subject. "Fonseca assures me they will have the terrorist in custody soon."
He used the word terrorist intentionally in hopes of snapping the prince out of his daze, but the prince only gave another blank nod.
"The president has denounced the assassination," Garza continued, "but the government does hope that you will further comment, considering Ambra's involvement with the event."
Garza paused.
"I realize the situation is awkward, given your engagement, but I would suggest you simply say that one of the things you most admire in your fiancée is her independence. And while you know she doesn't share the political views of Edmund Kirsch, you applaud her standing by her commitments as director of the museum. I'd be happy to write something for you, if you like. We should make a statement in time for the morning news cycle."
Julian's gaze never left the window.
"I'd like to get Bishop Valdespino's input on any statement we make."
Garza clenched his jaw and swallowed his disapproval. Post-Franco Spain was an estado a confessional, meaning it no longer had a state religion, and the church was not supposed to have any involvement in political matters. Valdespino's close friendship with the king, however, had always afforded the bishop an unusual amount of influence in the daily affairs of the palace. Unfortunately, Valdespino's hardline politics and religious zeal left little room for the diplomacy and tact that were required to handle tonight's crisis. "We need nuance and finesse, not dogma and fireworks." Garza had learned long ago that Valdespino's pious exterior concealed a very simple truth. Bishop Valdespino always served his own needs before those of God. Until recently, it was something Garza could ignore. But now, with the balance of power shifting in the palace, the sight of the bishop sidling up to Julian was a cause for significant concern. "Valdespino is too close to the prince as it is." Garza knew that Julian had always considered the bishop family, more of a trusted uncle than a religious authority. As the king's closest confidant, Valdespino had been tasked with overseeing young Julian's moral development, and he had done so with dedication and fervor, vetting all of Julian's tutors, introducing him to the doctrines of faith, and even advising him on matters of the heart. Now, years later, even when Julian and Valdespino did not see eye to eye, their bond remained blood deep.
"Don Julian," Garza said in a calm tone, "I feel strongly that tonight's situation is something you and I should handle alone."
"Is it?" declared a man's voice in the darkness behind him.
Garza spun around, stunned to see a robed ghost seated in the shadows. Valdespino.
"I must say, Commander," Valdespino hissed, "I figured that you of all people would realize how much you need me tonight." "This is a political situation," Garza stated firmly, "not a religious one."
Valdespino scoffed.
"The fact that you can make such a statement tells me that I have grossly overestimated your political acumen. If you would like my opinion, there is only one appropriate response to this crisis. We must immediately assure the nation that Prince Julian is a deeply religious man, and that Spain's future king is a devout Catholic."
"I agree, and we will include a mention of Don Julian's faith in any statement he makes."
"And when Prince Julian appears before the press, he will need me at his side, with my hand on his shoulder, a potent symbol of the strength of his bond with the Church.
That single image will do more to reassure the nation than any words you can write. Garza bristled. The world has just witnessed a brutal live assassination on Spanish soil, Valdespino declared. In times of violence, nothing comforts like the hand of God. Chapter 31. The Széchenyi Chain Bridge, one of 8 bridges in Budapest, spans more than 1,000 feet across the Danube. An emblem of the link between East and West, the bridge is considered one of the most beautiful in the world. What am I doing? Wondered Rabbi Kirvish, peering over the railing into the swirling black waters below. The bishop advised me to stay at home. Kirvish knew he shouldn't have ventured out, and yet, whenever he felt unsettled, something about the bridge had always pulled at him. For years, he'd walked here at night to reflect while he admired the timeless view. To the east, in Pest, the illuminated facade of Gresham Palace stood proudly against the bell towers of St. István Basilica. To the west, in Buda, high atop Castle Hill, rose the fortified walls of Buda Castle. And northward, on the banks of the Danube, stretched the elegant spires of the Parliament building, the largest in all of Hungary. Kirvish suspected, however, that it was not the view that continually brought him to Chain Bridge. It was something else entirely. The padlocks. All along the bridge's railings and suspension wires hung hundreds of padlocks, each bearing a different pair of initials, each locked forever to the bridge. Tradition was that two lovers would come together on this bridge, inscribe their initials on a padlock, secure the lock to the bridge, and then throw the key into the deep water, where it would be lost forever, a symbol of their eternal connection. The simplest of promises, Kirvish thought, touching one of the dangling locks. My soul is locked to your soul forever. Whenever Kirvish needed to be reminded that boundless love existed in the world, he would come to see these locks. Tonight felt like one of those nights. As he stared down into the swirling water, he felt as if the world were suddenly moving far too fast for him. Perhaps I don't belong here anymore. What had once been life's quiet moments of solitary reflection, a few minutes alone on a bus, or walking to work, or waiting for an appointment, now felt unbearable. And people impulsively reached for their phones, their earbuds, and their games, unable to fight the addictive pull of technology. The miracles of the past were fading away, whitewashed by a ceaseless hunger for all that was new. Now, as Yehuda Kirvish stared down into the water, he felt increasingly weary. His vision seemed to blur, and he began to see eerie, amorphous shapes moving beneath the water's surface. The river suddenly looked like a churning stew of creatures coming to life in the deep. "Avis El," a voice said behind him. "The water is alive." The rabbi turned and saw a young boy with curly hair and hopeful eyes. The boy reminded Yehuda of himself in younger years.
"I'm sorry,"
the rabbi said. The boy opened his mouth to speak, but instead of language, an electronic buzzing noise issued from his throat and a blinding white light flashed from his eyes. Rabbi Kirvish awoke with a gasp, sitting bolt upright in his chair.
"Oy, Gewalt!"
The phone on his desk was blaring, and the old rabbi spun around, scanning the study of his haziko in a panic. Thankfully, he was entirely alone. He could feel his heart pounding. Such a strange dream, he thought, trying to catch his breath. The phone was insistent, and Kirvish knew that at this hour it had to be Bishop Valdespino calling to provide him with an update on his transportation to Madrid.
"Bishop Valdespino," the rabbi answered, still feeling disoriented. "What is the news?"
"Rabbi Yehuda Kirvish,
an unfamiliar voice inquired.
You don't know me, and I don't want to frighten you, but I need you to listen to me carefully.
Kirvish was suddenly wide awake. The voice was female, but was masked somehow, sounding distorted. The caller spoke in rushed English with a slight Spanish accent.
I'm filtering my voice for privacy. I apologize for that, but in a moment you will understand why.
Who is this? Kirvish demanded.
I am a watchdog, someone who does not appreciate those who try to conceal the truth from the public.
I don't understand.
Rabbi Kirvish, I know you attended a private meeting with Edmund Kirsch, Bishop Valdespino, and Alama Sayed Al-Fadl 3 days ago at the Montserrat Monastery.
How does she know this?
In addition, I know Edmund Kirsch provided the three of you with extensive information about his recent scientific discovery, and that you are now involved in a conspiracy to conceal it.
What?
If you do not listen to me very carefully, then I predict you will be dead by morning, eliminated by the long arm of Bishop Valdespino.
The caller paused.
Just like Edmund Kirsch and your friend, Sayed Al-Fadl.
Chapter 32 Bilbao's La Salve Bridge crosses the Nervión River in such close proximity to the Guggenheim Museum that the two structures often have the appearance of being fused into one. Immediately recognizable by its unique central support, a towering bright red strut shaped like a giant letter H, the bridge takes the name La Salve from folkloric tales of sailors returning from sea along this river and saying prayers of gratitude for their safe arrival home. After exiting the rear of the building, Langdon and Umbra had quickly covered the short distance between the museum and the riverbank and were now waiting, as Winston had requested, on a walkway in the shadows directly beneath the bridge. Waiting for what? Langdon wondered, uncertain. As they lingered in the darkness, he could see Umbra's slender frame shivering beneath her sleek evening dress. He removed his tail's jacket and placed it around her shoulders, smoothing the fabric down her arms. Without warning, she suddenly turned and faced him. For an instant, Langdon feared he had overstepped a boundary, but Umbra's expression was not one of displeasure, but rather one of gratitude.
Thank you,
she whispered, gazing up at him.
Thank you for helping me.
With her eyes locked on his, Umbra Vidal reached out, took Langdon's hands, and clasped them in her own, as if she were trying to absorb any warmth or comfort he could offer. Then, just as quickly, she released them.
Sorry,
she whispered.
Conducto impropria, as my mother would say.
Langdon gave her a reassuring grin. Extenuating circumstances, as my mother would say. She managed a smile, but it was short-lived.
I feel absolutely ill, she said, glancing away. Tonight, what happened to Edmund?
It's appalling. Dreadful, Langdon said, knowing he was still too much in shock to express his emotions fully. Umbra was staring at the water.
And to think that my fiancé, Don Julian, is involved.
Langdon could hear the betrayal in her voice and was uncertain how to reply. I realize how it appears, he said, treading lightly on this delicate ground. But we really don't know that for sure. It's possible Prince Julian had no advance notice about the killing tonight. The assassin could have been acting alone or working for someone other than the prince. It makes little sense that the future king of Spain would orchestrate the public assassination of a civilian, especially one traceable directly back to him.
It's only traceable because Winston figured out that Avila was a late addition to the guest list. Maybe Julian thought nobody would ever figure out who pulled the trigger.
Langdon had to admit she had a point.
I never should have discussed Edmund's presentation with Julian. Umbra said, turning back to him.
He was urging me not to participate, and so I tried to reassure him that my involvement would be minimal, that it was all nothing but a video screening. I think I even told Julian that Edmund was launching his discovery from a smartphone. She paused. Which means, if they see that we took Edmund's phone, they'll realize that his discovery can still be broadcast. And I really don't know how far Julian will go to interfere.
Langdon studied the beautiful woman a long moment. You don't trust your fiancé at all, do you? Ambra took a deep breath.
The truth is, I don't know him as well as you might assume.
Then why did you agree to marry him?
Quite simply, Julian put me in a position where I had no choice.
Before Langdon could respond, a low rumble began shaking the cement beneath their feet, reverberating through the grotto-like space beneath the bridge. The sound grew louder and louder. It seemed to be coming from up the river, to their right. Langdon turned and saw a dark shape speeding toward them, a powerboat approaching with no running lights. As it neared the high cement bank, it slowed and began to glide up perfectly beside them. Langdon stared down at the craft and shook his head. Until this moment, he had been unsure how much faith to place in Edmund's computerized docent. But now, seeing a yellow water taxi approaching the bank, he realized that Winston was the best ally they could possibly have. The disheveled captain waved them aboard.
"You're British man," he called me.